south pole front right now, one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way, when all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we will be reading from Cowboy Short Stories, published by Blue Ribbon Magazines in November 1939. A reminder that our stories are sometimes edited for recording. Our first story is entitled Dry Gulchers Can't Quit by L.L. Thompson. No one spoke to the tall, gaunt rider on the long-legged dun mare as man and horse came slowly along the muddy, rutted main street of Mesita. The Cheyenne kid smiled bitterly. He knew what invoked the fear, the distrust, and the contempt on the faces of men when they looked at him. He knew he wore the brand of killer in his hard, expressionless gray eyes, in the relentless, immobile lines around his thin, gashed lips. A little while ago, when he had ridden through Sun Pass and looked down on Signal Valley, green and jewel-like under the glory of a great misty rainbow, he had felt a thrill of homecoming. It came to him then that perhaps this, his home range, could be a haven for him where he could settle down and forget about those lonely, blood-drenched years on the border trails where the Cheyenne kid and his gun, for sale to the highest bidder, had carved for themselves a sinister fame. Then he looked down at his tied gun, a reminder of his mission here, and he realized that there could never be any peace for him in Signal Valley if he persisted in going through with the job ahead. And go through with it he must, or die. Now Cheyenne's lips curled in sardonic self-ridicule. No matter what he did or didn't do, he couldn't live down his past. He'd been a fool to think even for a moment that because a certain night of gun flame and death at San Carlos had changed him so that his own mother wouldn't have recognized him, he could fool the men of Signal Valley, live among them as one of their own kind. In a way, he could fool them. No one would recognize the white-haired Cheyenne kid with the puckered scars which had changed the modeling of his lean face, and the useless, crippled left hand. They wouldn't know he was the same Dan Clayton who had ridden out of this valley 8 years ago, just two jumps ahead of a law posse. A wild young kid who'd gotten drunk and killed a cheating tin-horn gambler in a saloon brawl. They wouldn't know him, but they'd know he was a killer, and they'd hate him, even if he didn't go through with the gun job that waited for him here in Mesita. He'd gone a long way since he had left Signal Valley. Until 3 years ago, he'd been Dan Clayton, an outlaw with a bounty price on his head. At San Carlos, Dan Clayton had disappeared, so far as the world was concerned, and the Cheyenne kid was born in his stead. A man with a new face and a new reputation. The law couldn't touch the Cheyenne kid. A hired gunman, he always drew last, and triggered first. He'd killed a lot of men. Most of them had deserved killing. But there were times when Cheyenne had to send good men to Boot Hill, wild youngsters who sought glory by facing his guns, earnest lawmen who pursued him with the zeal of crusaders. Sometimes the voices and the faces of those dead men came stealing into his dreams. But folks didn't know that. They called him inhuman, a born killer. They would have laughed if anyone told them the Cheyenne kid was tired of handing out one-way tickets to Boot Hill. Cheyenne shrugged his broad shoulders resignedly as he racked his bronc in front of the Paradise Saloon. He told himself he didn't give a damn. He'd known all along that he couldn't lay aside his gun. He told himself he'd go crazy, living the tame kind of life these ranchers and cowpokes lived. The Cheyenne kid told himself that, but just before he battened through the wing doors of the Paradise, he stared down the street at a smiling rancher who was helping his slim, clear-eyed wife onto the high seat of a buckboard. Cradled in the woman's arms was a tiny, curly-headed button, laughing up at his mother. That childish laughter seemed to do something to the Cheyenne kid. If a passerby had looked at his eyes now, he would have seen that they weren't hard, expressionless. They were soft, almost wistful. A spasm of purely physical pain flashed across Cheyenne's face, and he turned away abruptly, strode into the smoke-dim interior of the paradise. His eyes were alert, stone-hard now, his mouth grim. He couldn't step out of his role of killer yet, for he must get relief from the dull ache along his spine, where lead from a lawman's gun had lodged and was poisoning his system, slowly killing him. There was a man in Mesita who would pay him for a gun job he wanted done, pay him enough so that Cheyenne could go to a specialist in Chicago and have that crippling slug cut out of his back. It had to be done, the kid knew, remembering the warning of a medico in Mesa City. I'll give you approximately 6 months to live if that irritation isn't removed within the next few weeks, the doctor had told him a month ago. Once the infection becomes widespread, it means you're finished. The office was blue with cigar smoke. Through that pungent haze, the Cheyenne kid stared coldly at Rance Bardell, the proprietor of the paradise. He didn't like Bardell's shifty, slitted eyes. He didn't like the contemptuous, sneering smile that wreathed the big man's face whenever he spoke of the nesters and small ranchers of Signal Valley. The look of the man and the way he wore his guns told Cheyenne that Rance Bardell was a killer, the kind who carved notches on his sixes and whose dreams were never troubled by the ghosts of the men his guns had sent to Boot Hill. You sent for me? Cheyenne said imperturbably. Bardell's cruel lips spread in a grin. 3 years ago, an outlaw, Dan Clayton, pulled a job down in San Carlos. Folks say he died that night, but I know different. A Mex friend of mine, Juan Flores, nursed Clayton back to life. Clayton became the Cheyenne kid. Me? I've been wanting you on my payroll ever since that San Carlos job, kid. 6 notches for your gun, all in 10 minutes of shooting. Cripes, that was... Exactly what do you want done, Bardell? The Cheyenne's kid's voice was like a breeze off a snowfield, and his pale eyes flamed with greenish lights. It disturbed him that Bardell knew his real identity, and he wasn't proud of the San Carlos affair. He wanted to forget the men who had gone down before his guns that night. And, as always, cold hate seethed within him as he thought of the trusted partner who had deserted him, left him to face the law guns alone. Rance Bardell's eyes narrowed, and the dark blood mounted to his face at Cheyenne's rebuff. He studied the gunman's still face, noted the way he wore his single-thonged six-shooter. Then he relaxed. I know you don't hire out to kill decent men, kid, he began. You can rest easy that the two hombres I want out of the way are the kind that deserve to die. One of them is Ripley Pawson, a tin-horn gambler and gunman who owns the Oro Grande Saloon here in town. He's trying to run me out of business, figuring there's room for only one saloon in Mesita, his. Him and his brother Jack have already gunned down two of my house gamblers. I'm next in line. But I wouldn't have a chance against Ripley Pawson. He's too fast on the draw. Cheyenne's face remained immobile. And the other man you want annihilated, is it this Jack Pawson? He drawled. Bardell shook his head. Nah, he's a weakling. He won't go on fighting me after his gunhawk brother's dead. Bardell pinched his cigar between thumb and fingers, studied it with veiled eyes. I own a ranch here. One of my neighbors has given me trouble. Since I killed a friend of his in a fair fight, he's been trying to frame me. Keep shooting off his mouth, accusing me and my riders of the rustling that goes on here in the valley. He's got influence here. I want him shut up for good before he gets some of his hot-headed friends to form a vigilance committee and come calling for me with a lynch noose. The Cheyenne kid eyed Rance Bardell somberly as the man held a match to his cold cigar. Cheyenne didn't like the job ahead, He was tired of the sound of dying voices in his ears, the sight of pain-contorted faces flitting through his dreams. Rance Bardell's figure blurred suddenly before him and cleared. Cheyenne's face remained wooden, not hinting at the shaky, sick feeling inside him. It was the old familiar pain again. The Cheyenne kid's eyes hardened. Now was no time to be squeamish. What the hell difference would two more ghosts make anyway? "I'll take the job," he told Bardell. "It'll cost you $3,000 in advance." Bardell snorted incredulously. "You're a robber, man," he snapped. "I'll get somebody else."
"One of your own men?" Cheyenne said smoothly. "What if he's caught and your name is dragged out into the mess?"
"Me? I never bungle a job, and I never get caught." Bardell scowled. Resentment smoldered in his eyes. But Cheyenne had a feeling that the man wasn't particularly displeased. "Okay, kid," he said quickly. Too quickly. The Cheyenne kid felt a warning stir inside his brain. Bardell was not to be trusted, he told himself. "This hombre's name is Doc McKay. He..." Cheyenne didn't hear the rest of what Bardell was saying. At mention of that name, he had gone white, tense. Doc McKay. Bardell wanted him to kill Doc McKay, the man who had been Tumbleweed. Bardell scowled. The man who had been Tumbleweed Smith, Cheyenne's partner? The man who deserted him, run out on him that bloody night at San Carlos? The Cheyenne kid knew Doc McKay was Tumbleweed Smith because he'd found out that his ex-partner had shown briefly in the border towns. He had turned straight and was back at his old profession of doctoring, and he was going by the name of McKay. Cheyenne almost laughed out loud. Killing the medico would be a pleasure. In a single, lithe moment, he leaned forward, scooped up the banknotes that Bardell had placed on the desk. "Where will I find McKay?" he said quickly, eagerness sharpening his voice. Bardell frowned. "Hold on, kid," he rasped. "I want Ripley Pawson out of the way first. McKay rode over to Sagetown on business today. He won't be at his ranch until tonight. Ripley Pawson will be riding into Mesita along about sundown, as usual. Get him, then go after McKay." During the afternoon, sullen, massed clouds gathered for a downpour. Through a rift in those clouds, a setting sun was sending shafts of crimson light over the prairie like trailing bloody fingers when the Cheyenne kid faced Ripley Pawson in front of the Oro Grande saloon. The Cheyenne kid felt no qualm of misgiving, no regret as lead from his bucking gun brought Pawson down. The evil-eyed, gun-swift gambler was of a breed he knew well. The same treacherous, ruthless killer breed as Rance Bardell. Cheyenne watched the man pitch to the boardwalk, then turned to go.
"Dirty killer!"
The Cheyenne kid turned inscrutable eyes on the man who darted out of the Oro Grande to run to Pawson's huddled figure. Cheyenne saw another Ripley Pawson and knew that this was the dead gambler's brother Jack. He waited, but Jack Pawson made no move for his gun. Fear matched the hate flaring in his beady eyes. Cheyenne moved away as onlookers closed in to stare at death. He went to the livery and got his dun mare. Lightning split the cloud-black sky, and thunder muttered, drew into an earth-shattering cannonade as he rode out of town, followed Angel Creek northward. Cheyenne stared ahead, to where low, crumpled hills melted into the murky sky. He was on his way to Doc McKay's, three-in-a-box spread. A chill eagerness seethed inside him as he thought of the coming showdown. His face was calm as he rode along, but his mind was in a turmoil. He was remembering that night, 3 years ago, when his partner, Tumbleweed Smith, who was now Doc McKay, had double-crossed him. He made a disgusted sound deep in his throat, remembering how he'd trusted Tumbleweed. He had told himself his partner was too square and honest for the Owl Hoot.
Tumbleweed had been a medico before circumstantial evidence railroaded him into a prison term for a robbery he didn't commit. Cheyenne had met him after Tumbleweed's release from Yuma. The two of them teamed up. Their dark trail partnership was 7 months old on the night they rode into San Carlos. The Cheyenne kid had been Dan Clayton, outlaw, then. They lost a lot of money in a crooked game at Dice Gunther's notorious Gold Palace gambling hall. When they called Gunther for cheating, three house gamblers stuck guns in their backs and threw them out of the place. Tumbleweed blamed Dan for their predicament. "We had enough money to quit outlawing," he complained. "But you talked me into having one more fling, buying drinks and bucking a game at Gunther's. Now we're broke." "Stop beefing," Dan had said. "We'll get it back." That night they climbed through a window into the office of the Gold Palace. Dan's educated fingers opened the safe. Tumbleweed was stuffing the loot into a burlap sack when a door burst open and Dice Gunther appeared with a scattergun. Dan Clayton's first shot brought him down. Then all hell broke loose. Men came running. Gunther, firing from the floor, kept Dan busy until the building was surrounded. Tumbleweed wasn't much help in the melee that followed. Gun talk always scared him stiff, made him too paralyzed to shoot straight. Dan fought like a demon. Again and again, his own particular brand of Apache war whoop flung defiance at the besiegers. Suddenly, he missed his partner. Tumbleweed was gone. So was the bag of loot. Dan ran to a side window in time to see his partner, mounted, flash past and disappear down an alley. Lone-handed, wounded, Dan fought on, cursing Tumbleweed's infamy. He was halfway out of a window when somebody brought the muzzle of a shotgun down across his knuckles with a bone-splintering crash. With the broken hand dangling useless at his left side, he ran a hot lead gauntlet to his horse. Hours later, weak from half a dozen wounds, he fell from his blood-soaked saddle. He would have died out there in the hills if Juan Flores, a Mexican goat herder, hadn't found him and nursed him back to life. Now, as he rode away from Mesita, the Cheyenne kid looked down at his maimed left hand, a hand that was twisted, crippled, permanently. Never again would it hold a gun. That brought down Cheyenne's chances for a long life just exactly half. And that wasn't all. He couldn't hold his Bronx reins with that hand either. He couldn't feed himself with it or pull on his clothes. He couldn't do a damn thing with it. Cheyenne would never get over the humiliation of being partially helpless. He had been a two-gunman. Now he carried one gun, and he was a cripple. With all the bitterness in him, he cursed Tumbleweed Smith. If Tumbleweed hadn't left him to fight his way out alone, this wouldn't have ever happened. Two of them could have held the lawman off so that they would never have gotten in close enough for hand-to-hand fighting. Cheyenne would have had a strong left hand instead of a withered, nerveless thing that was worse than no hand at all. And if Tumbleweed hadn't run off with the money, Cheyenne would have plenty for that operation he needed on his back without earning it all over again with blood and lead. He chuckled mirthlessly as he thought how nearly Tumbleweed had come to escaping his vengeance-dealing gun. Cheyenne had been on the lookout for Tumbleweed for 3 long years. Now, by a lucky accident, he knew where to find him, could settle the score between them. It seemed that fate was stepping in to help him play this sinister game. The Cheyenne kid slipped in his saddle, peered along his back trail, listening. Then he faced around. It was thunder, not hoofbeats he'd heard, he decided. The roar of gunfire came from behind. Cheyenne, jerked upright in the saddle by a slug between his shoulder blades, twisted around to face his ambusher. Dropping the reins, he snatched his gun free of leather, sent lead crashing at a moving shadow back there in the brush, fringing the creek. "Jack Pawson," he muttered, "followed me to collect for his brother's killing." A cry of pain indicated he had struck a flesh-and-blood target. The dim bulk of a horse and rider plunged into the trail, hurtled back toward town. Flame streaked the night as the rider sent lead crashing at Cheyenne. Cheyenne's bronc was bolting now. The Cheyenne kid couldn't reach the reins he'd dropped. He couldn't do anything but hang on to all the leather he could find to keep from falling off. The jolting sickened him. He wanted to fall on the trail and lie there, anything to stop the agony which held him. But, instead, he clung to the saddle, his face gray with pain. He lost track of time and distance. Lightning danced in crazy arcs before his dimming eyes. Then the rain came. Presently, Cheyenne felt himself plunging down into thick blackness. Mud oozed against his face, squeezed up between his outstretched fingers. Then he no longer felt the cold, the wet. He didn't feel anything. The Cheyenne kid opened his eyes. A straight furrow of perplexity divided his forehead as he stared around the room. His chest was one big ache, and he felt weak as a kitten. Dimly, he remembered an endless interlude of pain and darkness. He saw the girl then, a pretty, bright-haired girl with eyes as blue as a summer sky. She smiled. Cheyenne's stern lips softened a little, and a strange new warmth seemed to flow around his heart, driving out some of the coldness bred there by hate and contempt. "You'll be all right now," the girl said in a low, pleasant voice. "My husband found you out on our east range, with a bullet wound in your lung. He operated, cut out the bullet. That was nearly a week ago." The warmth receded from around Cheyenne's heart. His face changed. "Your husband?" he whispered. "Is he a doc?" "Yes, Dr. Jim McKay. I'm Nancy McKay." Cheyenne's eyes flamed. He wasn't going to accept help, any more help from Doc McKay. He must get out of here. He tried to sit up, but savage pain and an overpowering weakness chained him. The girl came quickly to his side and laid a firm hand on his shoulder. "You must not move like that," she said urgently. "You might open the wound." "I can't stay here," Cheyenne muttered, not looking at her. "I'm riding on." Nancy McKay frowned at him as she would at a willful child. "You're staying," she said. "If you tried to leave now, you'd die of hemorrhage, or maybe get pneumonia. Please, don't argue. I won't leave this room until you drop off to sleep." The Cheyenne kid turned his face to the wall. He knew he was too weak to get out of bed without assistance. It was a hell of a situation, being here in Doc McKay's house, but he'd have to make the best of it. The next time Cheyenne awoke, he felt a little stronger. He wondered how long he'd been asleep, but he didn't ask Nancy McKay about that. Strangely enough, he was content to lie there and watch this vibrant, tanned ranch girl come and go as she moved about her work. Once, she let a shy, tow-headed button into the room. She told Cheyenne the button was her son, Jimmy McKay. It wasn't until Jimmy stumbled against a chair that the Cheyenne kid realized that the boy was blind. As the days passed, Cheyenne cursed more and more the fate which kept him here. Hell, if he stayed much longer, obediently swallowing the things Nancy McKay brought him to eat, following her and the button with his eyes every time they came into the room, he might go soft. He might forget that McKay was a double-crosser and must pay a double-crosser's price. The Cheyenne kid told the McKays his name was Tex. They accepted that without comment, asking him no questions. He saw very little of Doc McKay. Doc McKay was a typical, harassed country doctor, worn and tired from overwork and insufficient sleep. But it was something more than overwork which was etching those haggard, bitter lines around the young medico's grim lips, Cheyenne decided. Doc McKay was terribly worried about something. His wife was worried, too. More than once, Cheyenne noticed a discouraged droop to her sensitive mouth, the suspicion of tears in her blue eyes. The Cheyenne kid was relieved to see that McKay didn't recognize him. That would come later, he told himself grimly. when McKay would find himself looking into the muzzle of Cheyenne's .45. Sometimes Cheyenne would be thinking about that when young Jimmy came into the room and grinned at him. Then Cheyenne would feel guilty and ashamed, in spite of himself. He liked the kid a hell of a lot, and Jimmy liked him too. Whenever the button listened to Cheyenne's voice, there was a light of adoration in his small face that made the Cheyenne kid ache with regret of the kind of life he had led, a life which set him apart from people like Nancy McKay and Jimmy. Then, one night, Cheyenne awoke to hear low voices beyond a closed door. "I can't get alone anywhere," Doc McKay was saying. "I've got no security to offer. The ranch is mortgaged to the hilt now." Cheyenne heard the chair scrape back, heard footsteps pacing back and forth, then McKay's voice again. "I tell you, it's driving me crazy, Nance. $1,000 would pay for an operation that would make our boy see. $1,000! And I'm not man enough to get hold of it. I'm a failure. If I weren't, I'd be a successful surgeon now, with a big hospital back east. I'd be the kind of surgeon who could operate on Jimmy and make him well. But all I am is a kind of glorified horse doctor, a dumb pill thrower. I can't even earn a decent living for you and our boy. You'd be better off without me. You were getting along all right when you had that lunchroom job in town before you married me."
"Jim, stop it,"
Nancy McKay protested sharply. "Is it your fault if most of your patients are too poor to pay their bills? Is it your fault that Rance Bardell and his rustler crew are making all of us ranchers poor? Don't worry about the $1,000, Jim. We'll get it. Somehow. Sometime." "Sometime may be too late," Doc McKay muttered. "If we wait too long, maybe the boy's eyes will be injured beyond repair. I'm going to get that money right away. I know a way to get it."
"No, Jim,"
Nancy McKay's voice cut in.
"You promised you'd never step outside the law again. If anything should happen to you, I couldn't stand it. I love you so, Jim. I need you, and Jimmy needs you."
The Cheyenne kid pulled the covers over his ears, but Nancy McKay's voice seemed to vibrate through his brain ceaselessly over and over.
"I love you so, Jim."
A fiery pain licked across Cheyenne's back. It was the old trouble again, that lawman slug killing him. Cheyenne told himself he couldn't put off that operation much longer. Maybe it was too late even now to hope for a cure. He sat up. When his head cleared, he got out of bed and pulled on his clothes. He'd leave now. He told himself he would have left long ago before this if he'd been able. It had been intolerable being in the same house with the McKays. But neither Nancy McKay's kindness nor the fact that Doc McKay had saved Cheyenne's life was going to change the kid's plans any. The Cheyenne kid would show no mercy. Doc McKay hadn't given a damn what happened to the Cheyenne kid that night of gunflame and death in San Carlos. Cheyenne told himself he was going to kill Doc McKay, but not in front of Nancy McKay and the button. Tonight, Cheyenne would ride into town. Tomorrow, when McKay came to open up his office in Mesita, Cheyenne would meet him in a fair fight. Fair, but he knew how it would end. It would take a much better man than Doc McKay to match his gun speed. The Cheyenne kid slipped outside and saddled his long-legged dun. He felt light-headed, unsteady. Once in the saddle, he reined southward through the night. His face was drawn, white. There was a great longing in him to get this gun job over so that he could ride away, far from the legend of the Cheyenne kid. With some of the money Bardell had given him, he'd pay for that operation. Then he would hole up somewhere in the everlasting hills and live out the rest of his life in peace and contentment. Against the glitter of the stars, he seemed suddenly to see the faces of Nancy McKay and little Jimmy. All the long way into town, he kept seeing them. And before the lights of Mesita emerged from the darkness, he knew beyond doubt that he couldn't make himself go through with the killing of Doc McKay, even though he hated the man. "I hope Bardell blasts him to hell," he murmured through tight lips. "But me?
If I gunned him, I'd never have any peace, knowing Nancy McKay and the kid hated me. It was past midnight when the Cheyenne kid stepped into Rance Bardell's office. The big owner of the Paradise waited in silence for him to speak, his slitted eyes measuring, studying his visitor. Cheyenne took a roll of bills out of his pocket and threw the greenbacks on Bardell's desk. "Here's $1,500, half of what you paid me," he said. "I'm not killing McKay." Bardell's eyes burned with tawny fires. "I know why you ain't going through with the job," he drawled. "You've gone soft because McKay patched you up." Sitting there behind his desk, with shoulders hunched forward, the saloon man looked like some big, lithe cat tensing for a pounce. "When I heard you was hurt, I decided the McKay job couldn't wait until you got well," he went on. "I made other plans to get rid of the medico, plans that will go through tonight. There's a mass meeting here in town tomorrow, and I don't want McKay to be there with his vigilante talk." Bardell's arm moved from behind his desk. In his hand was a gun leveled at Cheyenne. "I decided to get rid of you at the same time," he told Cheyenne smoothly. "I was going to send you to Boot Hill anyway, after you finished off possing in the medico. But after you got shot up, I decided neither job could wait. I figured to ride out to McKay's and kill you both. But since you blundered in here, I'll accommodate you right now." The Cheyenne kid's eyes glittered, green and strange. His voice came like the cracking of ice. "So you planned a double cross all along, Bardell, and you lied about McKay. He wasn't framing you. He's been telling the truth. You're the kingpin back of the rustling here in the valley." Bardell's teeth gleamed white in the lamplight. "That's correct, kid," he chuckled. "I'll get back the money I paid you, all of it. And when I show the law it's the outlaw Dan Clayton I've killed, I'll get the $5,000 in bounty money on your head." Cheyenne's eyes burned into Bardell's. "Don't pull that trigger, polecat," he warned. "I can guarantee to kill you before I pass in my checks." Uncertainty flickered for a moment in Rance Bardell's eyes. His thumb, hooked over the gun hammer preparatory to cocking it, relaxed for an instant. Then, abruptly, he let the gun drop, and his hands jerked up, palms forward. For, magically, there was a gun in Cheyenne's hand now, its muzzle pointed at the third button on Bardell's ornate shirt. Cheyenne came forward, leathering his gun as he came. He picked up the weapon Bardell had dropped. "Stand up, hombre," he ordered. Bardell stood. The Cheyenne kid shoved the weapon into the saloon man's holster, then backed away. "All right, double-crosser," he said, smiling grimly. "Draw that cutter, and we'll see who sends who to Boot Hill." Bardell's lips went white. He made no move for his six-shooter. Hope and desperation warred in his eyes as footsteps sounded on the stairway. "Draw!" Cheyenne snapped viciously. Bardell's hand slapped leather. At the same time, he leaped aside to crouch behind his desk, and then gun thunder filled the room. Lead whipped past the Cheyenne kid from behind, and he whirled, saw a table lookout standing in the doorway, squinting at him along the barrel of a scattergun. Bardell, sheltered behind the desk, was triggering now. One leap took Cheyenne to the side window. He scrambled out onto the low roof, dropped off the edge to the ground. The exertion opened the wound in his chest. He could feel the wetness of the bandages. Feeling faint, he stumbled along the alley toward Main Street. A few buildings to the left was the livery where he'd left his horse. Cheyenne turned on Main Street. He coughed, wiped blood from his lips. Weakness surged over him, and he sank back against a shadowed wall. He looked up as the soft clop-clop of hoofs came along the moonlit street. Four riders drew up, grim-looking men with hats low drawn over their whiskered faces. Racking their broncs in front of the Paradise, they sat their saddles in silence, their hard glances fixed on the saloon batwings. The door swung open, and Rance Bardell strode out, his big face a scowl. Turning to the gun-hung individual who was following him, he issued a swift order.
"Clayton has sneaked out of town by now. He'll probably hit for Apache Pass," Cheyenne heard him say. "Get some of the boys and head him off, and don't bring him back alive."
The man topped a horse and hurtled away.
"Let's get going," Bardell snapped at the riders waiting at the hitch rack.
Cheyenne watched him mount, lead the four men out of town. He saw them turn northward into the Angel Creek Road, heading for Doc McKay's ranch. He smiled grimly. Bardell would kill McKay. Cheyenne told himself he was glad. On lagging feet, he went and got his horse. As he rode out of town, he felt the money in his pocket, and the bulk of it reassured him. He looked off to the west. There lay his gateway to freedom. Sun Pass, far to the west of the spot where the gunman posse would be seeking him. He sighed. Now he could have that slug cut out of his back. Then he'd put away his gun forever and forget the men he had killed. The Cheyenne kid bowed his head. Could he ever forget those hollow-eyed ghosts? And could he ever forget young Jimmy McKay with his wide, sightless eyes? Or Nancy McKay's earnest voice telling her husband how much she loved him? Cheyenne tried not to look down the road that Bardell and his men were taking. The distant pounding of the hoofs was like a dirge in his ears. In a little while now, those killers would ride up to the three in a box. They'd call McKay to the door, then they'd blast him. And the McKay's wife, his kid, would even they be safe from a callous devil like Bardell? Certainly not if they resisted him, Cheyenne knew. But even if Bardell left them unmolested, what then? If McKay died, the light of happiness would be gone from Nancy McKay's eyes forever. She and Jimmy loved the medico. Nothing could change that. Cheyenne groaned deep in his throat. There was one way to ensure the happiness of that clear-eyed girl and her little blind kid. The way of no return for Cheyenne. He pulled up abruptly. For a moment he sat there, brooding. Then he wheeled his bronc, galloped after the five gunmen. Presently he turned off the road, took a short cut across the hills to the three in a box. The Cheyenne kid stood in the shadow of a tall cottonwood and looked across at Doc McKay's little ranch cabin, peaceful in the moonlight. There was a soft, dreamy light in Cheyenne's eyes, a light that vanished as he heard hoofbeats. When Rance Bardell and his men rode up, Cheyenne walked out to meet them.
"This is my party, Bardell," he rasped. "Come and get it."
Bardell ripped out a startled oath, clawed at his holsters.
"Get him, boys," he yelled. "Get the dirty."
The roar of Cheyenne's gun cut him short. One of the horsebackers turned tail, spurred away in a panic. When Bardell screamed, slid backward over his horse's rump and crashed to the ground, a second gunman, triggering a pair of wild shots at Cheyenne, laid low on his saddle pommel and quirted his bronc back the way he had come. A third gunny was pouring a hail of lead at Cheyenne. Cheyenne staggered as a hot slug tore at his hip and another plowed through his shoulder. His lips writhed back and a yell of defiance burst from him. His own particular brand of Apache war whoop, trademark of Dan Clayton, outlaw. Then he felt the smashing impact of a slug in his chest. Bardell had triggered that shot, was up on one knee, blood pouring from his neck. The Cheyenne kid, sagging slowly, felt his gun buck twice more. Bardell's companion sprawled on the ground in an inert heap. Bardell stiffened, toppled backward. Cheyenne saw the big gunman's face in the moonlight, the expression of hate and surprise on it. He saw the oozing bullet hole between the staring eyes as Bardell crashed to earth. Cheyenne was on the ground now, too. He couldn't see very well. He heard voices, footsteps. Then they were standing over him, Doc McKay, Nancy, and Jimmy. There was terror, grief in the button's face as he knelt, groped for Cheyenne's hand.
"Are you hurt, Tex?" Jimmy gulped,
his small hand trembling in Cheyenne's big one. The Cheyenne kid managed to sit up. He saw Doc McKay staring at him.
"That Apache yell," Doc stammered. "I'd know it anywhere. You're Dan Clayton."
Nancy McKay's face was white and tear-stained.
"Carry him into the house," she implored.
Cheyenne shook his head.
"I gotta be going," he said. "There's a posse after me."
He got to his feet, went over to his tied horse. Doc McKay followed him. Cheyenne heard the medico's voice, telling him what a fine thing he'd done. That made a bitter smile curl the kid's lips.
"Yeah," he said for the doc's ears alone. "I done this for your wife and kid. I wouldn't give you a drink in Hades after the way you double-crossed me in San Carlos, lit out with the money that was half mine."
Doc McKay grasped his arm.
"Hell, Dan, I didn't run away with the money. Before I crawled through that window, I threw the sack aside. I was scared. That's why I ran. I admit I was a damn coward, Dan. Always was when the guns began to talk. You know that."
Cheyenne, in the saddle now, looked down at the medico and smiled wanly. He was glad, very glad, he hadn't let Doc McKay be killed. No one but the devil himself would curse a man for being afraid, he told himself.
"It's okay, partner," he murmured. "It might have happened to anybody. I'm sorry I judged you wrong. I should have known you didn't take the money."
As in a dream, Cheyenne felt Nancy McKay's gentle fingers on his arm, heard Jimmy sobbing, pleading with him to stay, but he knew he couldn't stay, and he knew he'd never be coming back. He leaned down and put a kindly hand on Jimmy's toe head.
"Don't fret, Button," he said huskily. "I'll see you again, someday. Just now the hills are calling me."
Out of his pocket, Cheyenne pulled the money he had collected from Bardell, $1,500.
"This is for Jimmy, to make his eyes well again," he said, handing the money to Doc McKay.
The medico's face looked bewildered in moonlight. He protested, but Cheyenne was adamant. The medico gripped Cheyenne's hand hard then, and his eyes showed the gratitude that he couldn't express in words. The Cheyenne kid wheeled the dun mare and rode away. Soft on the breeze, he could hear Nancy McKay's goodbye.
"God bless you, Tex," he heard her say.
The Cheyenne kid forgot his pain. The suggestion of a smile touched his stern lips. He had no regrets. His smile deepened. He was thinking of the gratitude in Doc McKay's eyes, the gentleness of Nancy McKay's goodbye. And he was thinking of a little, blind Button who would someday come out of the darkness into the light. The Cheyenne kid, through heavy lids, gazed up ahead at the rolling outline of Mustang Range, black against the starry sky. The high places were calling him, where a man could die with the sage-clean wind in his face, the brooding shadows of the ageless hills to stand sentinel for him at the gates of eternity. And that was Dry Gulcher's Can't Quit by L.L. Thompson. Now we will read Rattlesnake Ike by The Trail Boss. I've been fond of using the highly descriptive names Rattlesnake Pete and Alkali Ike to designate Wild Western characters. Few probably realized that such characters existed in pioneer times and in the flesh. Only, in the passage of time, the names have gotten reversed and their significance slightly twisted. In reality, it was Rattlesnake Ike and Alkali Pete. To be appreciated, this little story of these two most unusual characters needs to be a little personal. The writer knew both Rattlesnake Ike and Alkali Pete in his boyhood around the Western mining camps in the early 80s. It is to a boy that the characters would appeal most romantically. We remember them fondly, this altogether picturesque pair. They provided us with many a thrill and not a little spending money in our years between 7 going on 11. The fact that we learned in later years that Rattlesnake Ike, street vendor of snake oil, a cure-all for man and beast, and his business partner, Alkali Pete, a full-blood Arapaho Indian, routing out scallywags did not lessen them in our regard. Rogues they might have been, albeit most genial and entertaining rogues. And if they were scallywags, as the better elements in the Western communities insisted, then to us they were beloved scallywags. There's just enough of the old Wild Western devil in us to leave us hoping in fond memories that Rattlesnake Ike and Alkali Pete fully enjoyed the fruits of every dishonest dollar they cajoled from the gaping and gullible street crowds which were their daily meat. And we heard as a boy from the older pioneers that, after their day's work of street hawking was done, Rattlesnake Ike and Alkali Pete could put up a ruinously stiff game of stud poker. They were well liked on this account, if no other. Their joint poker prowess endeared them to the older pioneers, just as their street pitch shenanigans endeared them to the children. It remains that these popular mountebanks never actually injured anyone. Their snake oil was harmless. All it was goose grease anyway, and their stud poker was a form of practiced assault that caused pains only in the pocketbooks. They worked in the boom times when money was pretty much easy come, easy go. Motion picture and other revelations of boom times in the Old West are not exaggerations. A boyhood memory will serve to prove this. We can remember when small boys and girls were paid a big, round silver dollar just for running a little errand or doing a simple chore. They tossed dollars around much as pennies are handled now. The ground everywhere was giving up gold in large quantities. The mines were owned by carefree and extravagant individuals given to spectacular spending and not by carefully managed international corporations and syndicates, as is the case today. There's still plenty of gold in the West, but not enough of the old-time prospectors. But back to our heroes. Rattlesnake Ike and Alkali Pete were colorful bits that fitted jigsaw puzzle-like into kaleidoscopic pattern that was the old Wild West. The crowds in the camps took most of their relaxation, amusement, and much of their business into the streets, particularly in the afternoons and evenings. This was because the buildings were not ample to accommodate the crowds of highly good-humored and amiable folk. To do business with this crowd, merchants, gamblers, and the rest moved their counters up to their doors, and in many instances right out onto the sidewalks. The merchants took the inside of the walks where they would lean their stocks against the walls, and the gamblers, pitchmen, wandering minstrels, mountebanks, took to the curb. This friendly and profitable arrangement made Rattlesnake Ike and Alkali Pete members of the curb market, so to speak. They were among hundreds of itinerant medicine showmen, pitchmen, and gamblers who moved about among the camps doing a terrific business and having a lot of fun. These were these old medicine shows, all of a fraudulent nature. It is a fact that in 1878 a big Chicago medical concern was impressed with the profitable business being done by the cure-all fakirs in the West. This company, headed by Dr. Hamlin, went the medicine showman one better. Dr. Hamlin bought an elephant to head a parade of performers popular to the period. He turned this show loose with an expert and highly educated spieler and sold 10 cents worth of red pepper liniment at $2 a bottle. It was, as usual, good for man and beast. Prove it, the spieler demonstrator would rub a little on the bulging hips of Bertha the elephant. And if an elephant isn't a beast, then just what is an elephant? And furthermore, if the liniment wasn't good for Bertha, why did she not turn on her tormentors and stamp them out? Of course, the reasons were that Bertha's beauty was 2 inches of tough skin deep. Besides, Bertha had been trained to keep her trunk away from there so she wouldn't get the damned hot stuff up her snoot. The Hamlin Show, the largest free medicine show of its time, rolled up millions for Dr. Hamlin, but was not as successful in comparison as Rattlesnake Ike's pitch and some others. Yet, Dr. Hamlin was rich, and Ike was poor. The difference was that Dr. Hamlin was investing his profits in legitimate laboratories and sanitaria, and Ike and the other lesser mountebanks were piddling theirs. But Rattlesnake Ike liked his own way better. He saw old Doc Hamlin's show and made just one comment.
At feed time, it's a toss-up to see whether the elephant or the actors and actresses eat the most. I could send Alkali Ike over there and he'd eat everything in sight, including the trained dog act and Bertha. Rattlesnake Ike was originally a hardware salesman out of St. Louis who could pick a banjo and sing songs. He made just one trip as a hardware salesman. He got drunk in a saloon in Golden, Colorado, with an Indian who had just come up from Arizona and had Alkali all over his leather and beaded clothes. They went to sleep together and woke up together and never separated after that. The Indian who could handle snakes taught the snake charmer's art to Ike, and Ike says this broke him of the whiskey habit. Anyway, the Indian not only sold Ike the idea of the snake-charming business as a quick road to wealth, but also sold him a big basket of snakes and his own services. The snake oil, rub it on and get well. It limbers up the muscles and makes old people young, was an idea furnished by a town druggist in Golden when they went looking for some medicine that would sell at a big profit. Alkali Pete had a right to his name, for in roaming the deserts, foothills, and plains, hunting the deadly rattler, he would become dusty with the alkali of the sagebrush country. After long treks through the wild country, he would show up in the saloons of the West, his clothing white with alkali, and bearing a clothes basket full of deadly snakes. He'd been known as Alkali Pete for some years before he formed the medicine show combination with the St. Louis traveling salesman with a flair for the dramatic and the spectacular and the devil's own gift of gab. With Alkali Pete's help, Rattlesnake Ike garbed himself in a wild western costume which was part that of cowboy and part that of scallywag. He let his handsome auburn hair grow, and it fell about his shoulders in natural waves. He had the reputation of being the handsomest man of the Old West, with the possible exception of Texas Jack Omohundro, who was not a Texan at all, but came of a pioneer Southern California Spanish family. The two looked much alike, save that Ike was fairer complexioned. Texas Jack was a government scout and an Indian interpreter. Incidentally, he was an inveterate gambler and a deadly gunfighter. The two, at intervals, when they met, were cronies, and Alkali Pete always went along. Pete doted on Texas Jack because Jack could speak Arapaho as well as other native Indian tongues. All three of these odd characters were decent as far as the good pioneer women were concerned. They could be trusted in their relations with the wives and daughters of the miners and cowmen. This made them worthy of business patronage of the mining camps and the cow towns. The fact that the snake oil combination were scallywags, in a mercantile sense, made little difference to the broad-minded, easy-going people of the place and the period. The other medicine show troops, all of them larger than the snake oil pitch, were never as popular. The women bought snake oil because Rattlesnake Ike was handsome and the Indian impressive in full paint and feathers. The men bought it because Ike and Pete were placid, adroit, and companionable poker players. The fact that snake oil might not be all that was claimed as a cure-all never bothered anyone, not even the children with whom Rattlesnake Ike and his sophisticated Indian were great favorites. Ike and Pete would show up in a town garbed fantastically, as described. They would take up their place at the curb and pitch their high box full of jars of goose grease, perfumed with lavender and medicated with camphor and turpentine. They would open their basket of snakes, and a few minutes later snakes would be coiled about the two of them from their heads to their feet. Many of the reptiles would be the deadly diamondback rattler species, and some would be as long as 7 feet, with a bunch of rattles buzzing like electric buzzers. Every Westerner has a profound realization and respect for the diamondback rattler as a killer. There's not enough money in the world to hire the average Westerner to pick one of these venomous and deadly snakes off the ground. It's natural that the Rattlesnake Medicine Show went big and did a rousing business. Rattlesnake Ike would further entertain the crowd by singing and plunking his banjo, and the Indian would do his tribal whoops and dances. Then they would unload all the snake oil the traffic would stand and move on to a new pitch or a poker game somewhere or other.
The real secret of the success of Rattlesnake Ike and Alkali Pete was vested in a weird tribal ability of the Indian member of the firm. This Indian tribal trick was the ability to expertly remove a rattlesnake's fangs without injuring his health, pep, courage, or lessening the volume of his rattle. Otherwise, the snake oil combination of Ike and Pete would not have lasted any longer than it takes the human blood circulation to carry snake venom to the heart from any given anatomical location. Rattlesnake Ike and his Indian were playing a constant game with death, at that, for there was always a chance that Pete might inadvertently overlook a single snake in the fang extraction process. It was a good thing for Rattlesnake Ike that Indians are probably the least absent-minded people in the world. From infancy on, the early Indian's life depended on his alertness, not only to protect him from snakes, but his other natural enemies, including his own kind. And that was Rattlesnake Ike by The Trail Boss. Thank you for joining us again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.